And from your driveway or your living room or your kitchen or wherever you may happen to be, to the airways, we have now a session of From the Studio with two of our most frequent guests here in this studio. I think the parking places for you both are being assigned as we speak. And on the one hand, we have the Spokane Symphony Music Director, James Lowe. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Jim.
And another very familiar presence here in Spokane and in our studio, Zuhal Bailey.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Very good. And we have you two gentlemen here because you are together at last on stage in this performance that concludes the Spokane Symphony's Masterworks season. And it's a very full program in all aspects of that word, just as the last program was, although it's in a different sort of way. Of course, the creation by Franz Joseph Haydn was just this amazing, very fast-moving period of time spent in the theater. And this is a rival to it because it's chock full of music and music of different sorts. And I'm really looking forward to it. So, James, let's start with you and tell us a little bit about the piece that opens the program and just the program writ large also.
Well, the whole idea of the program really is that these are all pieces that tell a story through music or create a sense of place or an atmosphere through music. We actually started with the Tales of Hemingway was the first piece we put in. So Zuhal and I were, I don't know, possibly in the Davenport at some point lounge, cooking up future plans.
And of course, the Tales of Hemingway is the Michael Dougherty piece for cello and orchestra
that we'll be hearing this
weekend.
So that was the starting point for the program. And then I thought, I like this idea of storytelling through music. And so I had just recently discovered, and I can't remember who put me onto her, but this French composer, Camille Pepin, who's a young composer who has written this incredibly beautiful, quite compact 8-minute work, which deals with a Chinese myth. And it's the myth of a goddess who is, her job is to weave the clothes for the gods from the clouds. And she falls in love with a herdsman whose job is to provide milk for the gods. And of course, they neglect their duties, let's say, and the gods are very upset, so they separate them, and you can see them in the sky. There are two bright stars either side of the Milky Way, and they're separated by the river that's the Milky Way. And eventually, the seventh day of the seventh month every year, they're allowed to be reunited, and so a flock of magpies come, and they join their wings, and they form a bridge, and then the family is reunited. So it's a very beautiful story. Mm-hmm. But the way she creates this quite abstract mythology, you know, she takes the pictures from Claude Debussy's Nuage and uses that to represent this weaving together of clouds. And it's a very colourful, quicksilver piece, constantly kind of changing. It's not a kind of violent contemporary music piece at all. Mm-hmm. It's really just full of atmosphere and colour. And the way she uses the orchestra to shift these very subtle pastel colors is really beautiful.
On your way in this morning, one of the remarks you made was it's a very French piece.
It's very
French. Which I think really identifies it because it is the inheritor of the tradition of Claude Debussy and the direction of French music at that time, but with some more contemporary items added, specifically in terms of orchestral technique, yes?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So she has taken a lot of kind of more contemporary music techniques. For example, you know, playing crotales, which are these little metal plates that you normally hit and sound very sweet, but you can actually play them with a double bass bow, mm-hmm. and they make this beautiful kind of eerie siren kind of sound. So siren in the sense of the people on the rock, not the car alarm.
Right.
So she weds that, but again, within a lot of the kind of ideas and the feeling of French music. So this very cleverly orchestrated, very precise orchestration, with the aim of having a sound that is actually quite vague and cloudy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, that is certainly going to be a revelation for everyone. And that opens the second part of the program.
It does, yes. I was going to open the concert, but in rehearsals, I feel that the Elgar and the Respighi that we're playing are both pretty heavy hitter pieces. So mm-hmm. it's kind of for the health of the lips of our brass players, it's probably better to start with Elgar. So we start with Elgar in the South.
Right, because once you get going on the pines, then It does. It's not over till it's over for everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
Well, let's go back and kind of outline the program by its actual order. So we begin with music of Edward Elgar.
We do, who I adore. He grew up not very far from where I grew up in the middle of England. And we think of Elgar now as this very august and celebrated aristocratic composer. It wasn't like that at all. He was a pretty working class guy, very marginalized in society. And British society at the time, and possibly still now, is very stratified into where you were born and where you were born, certainly in his time. And sadly, really, again, now in our time, very much dictates how far you will rise in your life. And he became successful abroad, and then all of a sudden the British kind of discovered him. And then he became this very kind of aristocratic composer. But he really started as an outsider, and I think that's always important to remember. And it is high Victorian music. It's incredibly energetic. It's a little bit like Don Juan. It's basically a kind of postcard from his holiday in Italy.
And there's a little bit of irony in that, because Elgar was in a rough patch in his life when he wrote this piece. And he and his wife escaped to someplace they thought was going to be sunny and bright. But it didn't turn out that way, did it?
No, it was mostly raining. So I guess he felt very at home. But he was certainly, like so many people from Great Britain, you go to Italy and it is a very different world, even if it's raining. We live in a very grey country. You know, this is what we're used to. And the manners, certainly in his time, and the way people interacted, you go to Italy and it's totally different. It's a world that is vibrant and full of life and good food and wine and joy. And so I think for us as Northern Europeans, going to Italy is always an experience. And it's captured the imagination of countless artists from, you know, Shelley and Byron all the way through to Elgar. And, you know, I think it's still doing that.
Right. And that's certainly, as you described it, this joy in living with the finer, minor things of life. That's what's celebrated in this piece.
Absolutely. I mean, it really comes out of the gates charging. But it's not all just this kind of very muscular music. There's this very beautiful solo viola section in the middle, which he published separately as a work because it's such a beautiful tune. Mm-hmm. But I think, and the reason he uses a solo viola, I think, is in reference to the great Berlioz work, Harold in Italy, which
we just heard a piece of in the last hour.
Oh, so perfect timing.
So, yes, little bridge there. Thank you for that. We take ourselves to the south for that overture, essentially, because it is an occasional overture.
It is, although it's a pretty hefty overture. It's really, it's more of a tone poem, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's more like a Straussian tone poem. It's about 20 minutes long. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's how we start. And then we go further south from Italy. We go further south. We end in Spain with the Hemingway. The last movement of the Hemingway takes us to Pamplona.
Right, from sunny Italy to, I don't know, the northern woods, or perhaps a bull ring, or perhaps on the sea, trying to get a big fish back into port. That is the Tales of Hemingway by Michael Dougherty. Michael Dougherty, who's, of course, known in these parts, not primarily, but certainly for his Letters from Lincoln that was premiered by the symphony here, lo, those many years ago. This is a piece that was written, Zul, is a piece that was written for you by Michael Dougherty. So tell us a little bit about that, the situation for that commission.
I can't believe it's been over 10 years. In fact, the premiere was 10 years ago, mm-hmm. Very much almost on the day of when we're playing it here. I played with you the Elgar last.
We did, yes.
So that's an interesting comparison for those who remember this collaboration with myself and the Spokane Symphony a few years ago. Dougherty heard me play the Elgar with the Detroit Symphony, and he had been asked to go by the Nashville Symphony because they had commissioned him to write a piece, possibly a cello concerto. And he heard me play the Elgar on this cello that I have, and he came backstage very excited and said, I want this to happen. I see it. I see the piece I've always wanted to write about Ernest Hemingway. And interestingly, if you think about the structure of the Dougherty, it's very similar to the structure of the Elgar, four movements. And all the movements kind of also replicate in similar ways storytelling. And so he felt that the deep sounds and the kind of earthy breadth of my cello could really tell the story of Hemingway's involvement in writing and society and the world travel and war. And so he wrote this piece, and it was premiered with the Nashville Symphony in, I think, March of 2015. And it's a marvelous work. It's very athletic. It is absolutely cinematic. In fact, after we premiered it, I asked Michael if he writes movie music, because you can't not see things while you're watching the orchestra and the cello parts and the ocean and the running with the bulls and even I don't know if he did it. A lot of artists or composers won't tell you why they did certain things, but the use of the bow in the last movement from the flamenco guitar to the running with the bulls, it looks and feels like a sword. The way I'm having to navigate it around and to put it down and pick it up, it's as if I'm bullfighting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, literally, again, the spans of the cello from the lowest notes to the highest realms, it's a thrill ride. And I'm so thrilled that we get to bring it together as our friendships and our collaborations with the organizations, et cetera, and bring the community together to celebrate something that was actually celebrated quite heavily worldwide in 2017. So the premiere of this piece was recorded and it came out in 2016 and it won 3 Grammy Awards mm-hmm. in 2017 for Best Soloist, Best Piece, and Best Album. I don't know if any piece of new music has ever done that before, but I really think it's warranted with this piece. And on first listening, people are going to be screaming. I'm setting the bar really high, by the way. And if they're not screaming, I'll scream first.
Okay, there we go. It certainly does cover the range of, it's in 4 movements, and it covers the range of Hemingway's writing.
That's right.
And, kind of the essence of Papa Hemingway is always there in it. And before I start with this, one thing that I just came across in preparing for this is that Hemingway himself played the cello.
Yes.
Was not a cellist.
Well,
I
heard it very badly, but yes, he's when he was in Michigan, I believe, which is where Doherty is from, which is why the piece starts off in Michigan. So it's the connection of the two and the fact that that Doherty, of course, living there himself, but with the cello aspect of being in and Hemingway's life.
Hemingway, again, a fascinating character. Those of us in the Inland Northwest certainly point with a measure of pride that he spent a lot of his later years in Idaho. And was kind of one of the emblems of this part of the world, the ultimate rugged individualist. But it starts off, it's in 4 movements. The first one starts off with a reference to the Big Two-Hearted River, which is a story that came out in 1925. And again, this is having to do with the young man in Michigan. And it moves from there in the second movement to Hemingway's time in the Spanish Civil War, which is such a magnet for artists at that point in the 20th century. The reference is to For Whom the Bell Tolls, which mm-hmm. came out in 1940. Are there essences of each of these movements that you could?
Well, I mean, again, when you're saying these things, I'm thinking of the Elgar Concerto, because the Elgar's the first movement is so melodious and spins this kind of dreamy, hopeful aspect of life and never-ending melody. And then the second movement of the Elgar Concerto is very athletic and vibrant and virtuosic. And going to the Spanish Civil War, there's a lot of marching and spiccatos and effects that Doherty implies and implores, that it feels like you're actually marching on a battlefield, and there are bombs going off everywhere with the use of the harp and other aspects of the symphony. Again, I hope that the audience, when they witness this, they really sit back and watch the entire expanse of the orchestra visually, because the sonic nature of that coming at you is if you're literally in the middle of the making of a movie. Mm-hmm. It's spectacular. But what you're even just saying, Spanish Civil War, it is true to those titles. It's war. It's absolute war. I'm holding the bow in the second movement almost like a baseball bat, striking the cello, and as if I'm surviving with every ounce of my body. as I said, the first movement is the use of the cello and the glorious terms of just the sound of it,
mm-hmm.
And just singing as if to think, oh, what's the future is hopeful.
Right. Especially as you're out in nature and it's all glorious and you're young. And
right. Everything seems boundless.
The third movement takes us to a novella, The Old Man and the Sea, which many of us got to read in high school. And this is just the tension between man and nature. And do we win at the end of this one? Not so much.
Well, it's a rocky, scary movement. It's very low. It sounds like almost there are a men's chorus singing at one point with this section where the cello is providing the waves of the water with the bow. It's incredible. It's a movement that does paint a picture of being in a boat out in the sea and wondering what is going on with all aspects of life.
Right. And if those aren't familiar with the novella, it is an old man in his fishing boat who catches the big fish, this huge marlin, and tries to get back to home port and is constantly attacked by sharks,
right.
Which is kind of a figure for the lives of many people. Then we finish with the Sun Also Rises, his kind of World War I / bullfighting.
It's running with the bulls. It's the bullfighting, the bow usage of that. It's light everything on fire and watch it burn. I mean, it really is. I feel like I'm almost about to be gored at any minute playing this movement, and it does not stop.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you feel like it's about to stop, it ramps up even more, and it ends with such a bang that that's what I meant by the whole screaming thing. It's quite something. In fact, I remember that the world premiere, we didn't know how it was going to be received. Of course, no one does in a world premiere, and I've never been more excited when we finished to see the audience just explode with mm-hmm. excitement and mm-hmm. receiving this piece the way it does. And I guarantee you that Spokane will have not witnessed something as similar to this.
This would be a good point to drop in. I'm talking with Zul Bailey and also with James Lowe about the Ninth Masterworks program, the Spokane Symphony, called Tales of Hemingway. It is up this weekend at the Fox Theater at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, and before that at 7:30 on Saturday evening. I'm getting excited about thinking and talking about this. And that, of course, brings us to the concluding piece, a fave of many, many people, the music of Respighi.
Very subtle piece.
Very subtle, yes.
So this is Respighi's Pines of Rome. And he wrote three kind of big works depicting that city, Fountains of Rome, Festivals of Rome, and Pines. The Pines really is probably the most performed piece. It's what is certainly his most performed piece. It's for a very large orchestra, and each movement depicts a different set of pine trees in a different part of Rome. So we open with the Borghese Villa, where there are children running around, and you hear all the noise and the toys that they're playing with. And then we go to suddenly, it's like a jump cut in a movie. We end up the pines around a catacomb, and you hear this chanting. Almost, it feels like these kind of ancient souls arising out of the catacombs and singing their song. There's a beautiful moment with an offstage trumpet sounding very, very far in the distance, and then the music grows and grows and grows until these kind of souls go back into their grave. And then we have a really astonishing movement, the Pines of the Uniculum, which is the idea is it's this hill that overlooks Rome. And it's late at night on a summer evening, and it's one of those evenings where you have that feeling that you feel the earth giving off the scent of the heat of the day, and beautiful moment of stasis and calm, and just sheer beauty. And then there is a little, and I'm not going to give it away, because if somebody doesn't know the piece, he pulls a little trick at the end of this movement that is so spine-tingling and so magical. And that no other composer had done before. This was the first time anybody had done this. And I'm not going to tell them what it is. You have to come and hear the concert. But it is a moment where if you don't know the piece, the first time you hear it, you'll be looking around your shoulder, looking around the hall to find out what is creating this magical moment. And then the final movement is the Pines of the Appian Way, which really is the depiction of a ancient Roman army. And it starts very far in the distance, and bit by bit they get closer and closer and closer and louder until they enter into Rome in huge triumph. And it's a spine tingling, and it is also a very cinematic piece. And it's just, for me, a really wonderful way to kind of cap a great season of music, is with this huge, massive orchestra celebration.
And it was fairly prophetic of you to program a piece about Rome this week.
Well, I would like to state for congressional record that I had absolutely no part in the timing of the papal election, but it did happen to work out quite neatly.
Well, just take it and run with it. Absolutely.
Well, exactly. And also, what's quite nice, and I would love to say that this was done on purpose, but we started our season with a Grammy Award winning work and performer with Owed Ashin Pratt and Jesse Montgomery Rounds, and we are now ending with Tales of Hemingway and Zool. So we now have, we're bookending the season with Grammy Award winners. Now, when I programmed it, Owed Ashin had yet to win his Grammy. So it was, again, another phenomenally prophetic moment, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. We have a couple of minutes left, so could I prompt you to say a word or two about the upcoming season, and if there is anything especially you'd like to call everybody's attention to?
With great pleasure, yeah. So we have just launched our 80th season. So it's our 80th birthday next year. I think we're doing pretty well for the 80. We have it's a huge program of music. We start with Mahler's First Symphony. Mm-hmm. And I got to thinking, his relationship with Alma Mahler, of course, his wife, and at the time when he married her, she had actually already been dating another composer, Zemlinsky, who had been her teacher. And so she thought Gustav was a better prospect. So she left Zemlinsky and got together with Gustav. And then he immediately said, well, there's only room for one composer in this relationship, and that's going to be me. And so she stopped composing. And I thought there's a really interesting little through line here through the season of female composers from that kind of era and a little bit earlier, like Clara Schumann or Robert Schumann's wife, or Fanny Mendelssohn, Felix Mendelssohn's sister, who all wrote works in their early years up to the age of about 20, 25, and then for various different reasons stopped. And I think this idea of these kind of lost composers, these lost voices, is interesting. So we have a thread that runs through the season of these composers going all the way through. The big blockbuster work is Verdi Requiem, mm-hmm. For the chorale, who are sounding amazing every time they go out. I mean, you heard in the Haydn creation a couple of weeks ago, really, really phenomenal group of singers. And we have a new commission by Sidney Guillaume, who's a friend of the symphony, who've worked with us a number of times now. Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, some Rachmaninoff, Bernstein, West Side Story, Symphonic Dancers. It's a huge season, and I'm really excited about it.
And doubly appropriate, it being the 80th season,
right,
of the orchestra. Well, let's focus now to close on what's happening this weekend at the Fox Theater. Again, Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 3, with a talk by James Lowe and Zool Bailey an hour before each of those, where you can find out more about the music and just really be able to revel in the wonderfulness of it all. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here with us today and taking us on this journey.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And by the way, Michael Dougherty will also be in town for this.
Oh, that's super.
So he'll be at the shows. That's You'll super. Get to meet the master.
You'll recognize him because he's the tallest one in the room.
He's not a short man.
Yeah, yeah.